You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Our next three programs will feature the use of government repression to maintain specific social relations that reinforce the present system of haves and have-nots, and we'll look at the so-called USA Patriot Act in that context. In a recent press conference, War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld threatened both reporters and members of Congress with prosecution under the USA Patriot Act if they pursued questions regarding the administration's foreknowledge of the September 11th suicide bombing attacks or criticized George Bush's plans for endless war. News reports and public statements by high-ranking officials in several countries have confirmed that warnings of the 9/11 attack were given to the U.S. government by several foreign intelligence agencies, including those of Russia, Israel, Egypt, and Peru. The Israeli Prime Minister and the Russian President have gone on record about directing that warnings be delivered. FBI agents have also gone on record as receiving these warnings and attempting to pass them on to disinterested superiors. In spite of this relatively large body of people who were aware that an attack involving the hijacking of aircraft was planned, less than 24 men were able to hijack 4 airliners armed only with razor knives. Not even the most minimal directive to increase airport security measures was issued. But after the horse was out of the barn, a flurry of activity erupted in short order. While that activity, war abroad and increase of government and police powers at home, is purportedly in response to the attacks, the current facts as well as historical precedent shows that the particular nature of the responses are ones that further an ongoing agenda of social control that maintains and increases the wealth and power of those who already possess it. Here are some facts that have been widely documented in places other than corporate-controlled U.S. broadcast media. Fact: the attack on Afghanistan, which was launched in October and was portrayed as a response to the September 11 suicide bombings, had been planned out months earlier. The Taliban regime was aware of U.S. plans, as it had been threatened with military actions by U.S. government emissaries. Fact: Taliban representatives had been brought to Texas last year in an attempt to negotiate an oil pipeline through Afghanistan needed by oil companies to bring out oil from the Caspian Sea region profitably. The Taliban were not cooperative. Following the U.S. attack on Afghanistan and the subsequent removal of the Taliban from power, a leader, Hamid Karzai, was installed who had previously worked as a consultant for Unocal Oil Corporation, which was involved in the pipeline construction plans. Unocal has previously worked as a partner with the government of Myanmar, formerly known as Burma, to maintain slave labor for use in its pipeline operations there. Fact: the provision of the legislation that has become known as the USA Patriot Act had been drawn up several years earlier, a creation of right-wing think tanks based on federal law enforcement wish lists that had little to do with the sort of scenario that took place on September 11th. Many of its provisions had already been dismissed as unconstitutional when they were brought up as part of the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, signed into law by Clinton in the wake of the Oklahoma federal building bombing. The so-called USA Patriot Act was pushed through a browbeaten Congress, some of whose members are now complaining that they didn't know what they had voted on, as they weren't given time by the Bush administration to actually read the proposed legislation. With the notable exception of Senator Russ Feingold, the sole vote against the act, the rest of them, either knowingly or ignorantly, have bestowed dictatorial powers on a president and utterly destroyed the Bill of Rights, the only portion of the U.S. Constitution that actually benefits the average citizen. The Congress members protesting ignorance deserve as much censure as those who knew what they were passing, in my opinion, as they have failed to exercise the most basic requirement of their job as legislators, to know what they are voting on. They have all demonstrated their unfitness for their offices, while members of the Bush administration have demonstrated that they belong in jail, along with the Supreme Court justices that installed them. So much for those vaunted checks and balances they taught you in your high school civics class. Since neither the war on Afghanistan nor the USA Patriot Act were conceived in response to the September 11th attacks based on the known timeline, what threat did their creators have in mind, and who were the enemies? A look at some equally repressive periods of American history suggests that the Bush administration actions can be viewed as another chapter in the long class war waged against common people wishing to extend the promised life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness beyond the circle of a few wealthy white men. The ink was barely dry on the U.S. Constitution when Congress passed the first law criminalizing opposition to the government. The Sedition Act, passed on July 14, 1798, stated that any treasonable activity, including the publication of, quote, any false, scandalous, and malicious writing, unquote, was a high misdemeanor punishable by fine and imprisonment. This law was aimed at suppressing political protests and was thus a direct frontal assault on the First Amendment freedom of speech, says constitutional attorney John Whitehead of the Rutherford Institute. Under that law, Upton Sinclair, author of the classic novel The Jungle, was arrested in 1923 for reading the Bill of Rights at a rally for striking dock workers. Around the same time, Roger Baldwin, founder of the American Civil Liberties Union, was arrested for publicly reading the U.S. Constitution. Many other conscientious objectors to the government's actions found themselves silenced, sentenced, and sent up the river. As in the case of the Patriot Act, a foreign enemy was the justification used to whip up public fear and patriotic fervor. In this case, it was France, whose revolutionary government had attacked several U.S. ships and insulted U.S. emissaries in retaliation for the U.S. signing a treaty with England. Like the people who made up the Continental Congress, the original French revolutionists were petty nobility and relatively affluent and well-educated landowners, merchants, and professionals. They conceived of only persons such as themselves as deserving the rights of citizenship. In France, this initial group was swept aside by a bloody mass movement, and many of these original rebels against the French king ended up fleeing to America themselves to avoid the guillotine. In the United States, many folk who fought in the Revolution soon discovered that the promises articulated by their leaders were not being delivered. One famous example is that of Shays' Rebellion, led by former Revolutionary Army Captain Daniel Shays. Western Massachusetts farmers rose up against unsettled economic conditions and against politicians and laws which were grossly unfair to farmers and working people in general. They protested against excessive taxes on property, holding taxes which prevented the poor from voting, and governmental and court systems that were dictatorial and oppressive. Their actions included mobbing the court buildings in Northampton, Great Barrington, Worcester, and Concord, Massachusetts, to prevent the sitting of the courts, whose actions had been grossly unfair to working people. On August 29, 1786, rebel mobs stormed the courthouse in Northampton to prevent the trial and imprisonment of debtors. In September 1786, Shays and about 600 armed farmers stormed the courthouse in Springfield, Massachusetts. Governor Bowdoin countered with a militia of 4,400 troops. On January 25, 1787, Shays led 2,000 rebels to Springfield to storm the arsenal, but government forces of 1,200 soldiers led by General Shepard quelled the uprising. The rebels were captured and sentenced to death for treason in February 1787, but they were later pardoned. Throughout this nation's history, battle has raged on the field of racial and economic equality, and the rights and freedoms enjoyed today by anyone other than wealthy white men exist only because of determined resistance that cost many their liberty or their lives. At this present moment, the contested issue is whether corporate capitalism shall be installed as the de facto system of world governance. Though the increasingly militant protests at home and abroad are either ignored or belittled in major press outlets, be certain that the promoters and beneficiaries of the corporate globalization project are alarmed by the level of resistance, especially as they had not seen it coming. They had been unable to stamp out its originations in the Third World and have watched as the streets erupted in the industrialized West. Even if most of us are not aware of it, the only people with the power to stop them are us. They need our bodies to be soldiers and police, run their courts and jails, manage their profit-making activities, buy their products, invent their technology, and disseminate their ideology via the schools and the press. We don't need guns and bombs to block their plans. We only need to stop wielding theirs for them. And this can occur only when the understanding arises amongst us that they are indeed their guns, their bombs, their products, their profits, their government. 19th century British novelist Edward Bulwer Lytton's famous aphorism that the pen is mightier than the sword is clearly believed by every repressive regime that this species has produced. Throughout most of history, speaking against the ruler has been equivalent to taking up arms against the ruler. Rulers know, even if their subjects do not, that their subjects can bring them down by merely refusing to perform the duties assigned to them, by folding their arms and thinking for themselves. Free speech and the free press are therefore subversive activities, because they lead to free thought and free action. The CIA has acknowledged this in their training manual. Quote, "In effect, the human being should be considered the priority in a political war, and conceived as the military target. The human being has his most critical point in his mind. Once the mind has been reached, the political animal has been defeated without necessarily receiving bullets." Close quote. Tonight we bring you a selection of people speaking and thinking freely in opposition to the tide of repression flying in under the cover of patriotism. A famous USA patriot, Patrick Henry, rose to speak in the Virginia Convention in 1765. Henry said, "Caesar had his Brutus, Charles I, his Cromwell, and George III. He was interrupted by the cry treason from the presiding officer as he continued, and George III may profit by their example. If this be treason, make the most of it."
We used to have elections and we don't bother anymore. Now it's just backroom dirty deals behind cloak and dagger doors. Oil money, family fortune, slapping each other on the back. Putting people's lives in their pockets and watching while the money stacks. Goodbye, America, I'll say I knew you when. He was a long corner, turning, gonna be a long corner. Turning back again. We used to have our liberties back in the day. But it was for our own good that they took them away. Now it's homeland security following you around. Old George cut that cherry tree and I guess it finally hit the ground. Cause there's a new George now. And he's got an axe of his own. And he's grinding it real sharp and he's cutting it to the bone. Filet of America and he'll feed it to the dogs. All for a bunch of good old boys riding high on the hog. Goodbye America, I'll say I knew you when. It was a long corner, turning, gonna be a long corner. Turning back again.
Our first speaker is Ward Churchill, professor of Native American Studies at the University of Colorado and a veteran activist of the American Indian Movement. He's the author of many books, including the COINTELPRO Papers. He spoke in New York City on February 24th.
I'm going to be speaking to a historical overview of the apparatus of repression, the evolution of it in this country. Probably with regard to the state apparatus of repression, the thing to be understood most clearly is that it is not new. It has been with us, for you can almost take your pick, throw a dart at a board, and pick a year in American history. Certainly, back into the COINTELPRO era of the 1960s, early 1970s. You had a full-bore program of political repression mounted by the federal government, but it had antecedents that date back to the Palmer Raids period, the end of World War I, slacker raids that preceded that in 1917. So that framing, which was pretty much at the advent of what was then called the Bureau of Investigation, but actually there's a precursor to the Bureau of Investigation that runs back to the Civil War and actually gets its legs and begins to run, becomes the template for the techniques of repression that are going to be applied forever after. Now, they've evolved them, they've refined them, they're more sophisticated in a lot of ways now than they were then, but the actual techniques that are employed to neutralize those who are considered, from the perspective of those in power, to be politically objectionable, really came out with a prefiguration of Ronald Reagan's privatization of government functions for the 1980s. That was occurring in the United States in the second half of the 1860s, when the investigative aspect for judicial enforcement of the United States of America was contracted out to private agency. That would be the Pinkertons. Now, I want to run you through a few cases, but I want to talk about the structural interlock, which you still see today. The Pinkertons, as a private enterprise, was retained by the federal government to fulfill the investigative functions of the government, whatever those might be. On the one hand, it wasn't profitable enough on that basis to function as a private sector business enterprise. It wasn't simply serving the government, and it wasn't your average factory worker or railroad section gang worker or field worker, obviously, who was paying for the services of the Pinkerton Detective Agency. While they were working on federal retainer, they were simultaneously working for the railroads, the steel mills, the coal mine interests, and so forth. So you had this sort of state corporate repressive interlock right from the very get-go. The interests were synonymous, and it really takes the form of that notion that what's good for General Motors is going to be good for the country. So they would be serving the federal interest by serving the interests of General Motors, and they would be serving the interests of General Motors by serving the interests of the federal government. And it was pretty much that clean. And it paved the way for a lot of things to happen. But mainly, what you have to understand, the mission from both or all three sides of the equation that's involved here, the mission of the repressive entity was to maintain order. They talk about law and order. Law serves order. That's the function of law. But this is the actual sharp end of the stick by which order is maintained. And the order is this. There is a place for everything in this society. There is a place for everyone in this society. An entity like the Pinkertons or what becomes the Bureau of Investigation or the FBI and all the interlocking local and state level agencies, their function is to make sure that everyone and everything stays in its assigned place. The one offense you can commit that will really warrant interest in the area that we're talking about is to attempt to change the place. Not so much of things, but of persons. And that could be true individually, but it's more true in terms of group interests. Okay, so groups are assigned their place. And we can talk about that, but I think probably that's an area wide of what I have time to discuss right now. We can come back to it, what this business of place is about, if you want. But let me run through a few of those early cases that emerged in the 1870s and the manner by which they were solved. You have a group in southern Indiana, which is called the Reno Gang. Now, this is not an explicitly political entity, but what this entity was doing as a criminal enterprise was expropriating the assets of railroads. They invented train robbery. Okay, that's contradicting. Yeah, contradicting the interests of the railroad magnates, obviously, but it's also contradicting the interests of the state because the state sees an interest in transcontinental laying of track and the communications ability, shipping ability, and so forth that arises from that. Now, the Reno's activities, not everybody wants to have the Reno's over to dinner in southern Indiana, you understand, but basically there is a social affirmation of what they're doing because in order to get the rights of way for the railroads, the government is using power of eminent domain to dispossess individual landowners and are running track across it, okay? So this idea, this group of guys coming out of southern Indiana kind of getting even with the railroads, very popular. They call in the Pinkertons to resolve that. They're unable to do it because of the popularity of these people. They're not exactly guerrillas, but it's the same principle that Mao articulated. Okay, the people become the sea in which the Reno gang swims. Consequently, by detective services, the Pinkertons can get nowhere. Ultimately, they catch one of the guys. This becomes instructive. It has to do with interrogation and creation of snitches, but also sending messages and the use of what Frank Kitson, a British counterinsurgency specialist of the 20th century, is going to call creation of pseudo-gangs to serve government interests. That is, creation of entities that don't otherwise exist. What are their criminal enterprises or political enterprises? They'll make them up out of whole cloth to serve various purposes. Well, they catch one of these guys. They got him locked up in a cell. Okay, he's not talking. That night, a lynch mob forms, comes down, overpowers the jailer, hauls him out of his cell down to an oak tree at the edge of town, announcing he's going to be hanged immediately if he doesn't divulge the whereabouts of other members of the gang, which he does, thereupon is hanged. Okay, they take the information, they grab two more of them, take them to jail cell where they're under lock and key. They're not talking, but that night a lynch mob forms, comes down, overpowers the turnkey, takes them out to the same oak tree, informs them same thing. That's how they roll up the gang. There's something really wrong with the picture if you think about it. These guys can't be caught because of the great degree of popularity evident for them in southern Indiana. Why is a lynch mob forming? Very nearly admitted late in his life in his memoirs by Alan Pinkerton that these were Pinkerton operatives, okay, impersonating a lynch mob for purposes of rolling up the case. Okay? Now, you got summary justice being dispensed. Obviously, the Renos are not going to continue their activities if they've been lynched, and they were very nearly all lynched before it was over. Okay? But creating a false impression as to public sentiment and several other political vectors enter into this. So this is one technique that you'll find being used certainly right up into the mid-1960s with the sort of use of Ku Klux Klan as a surrogate against the civil rights movement in the southern states. But it hasn't really outlived its usefulness now. But I'd say they establish a template there for operational method that allows them to retire a case in their mind satisfactory that has absolutely nothing to do with law enforcement. In fact, is flagrantly illegal, but very effective. And the object of these kinds of operations hasn't got to do with law enforcement, and that's stated straightforwardly by people who run FBI counterintelligence in the 1970s. Said success is measured in this area by neutralization of the target. If neutralization happens to be achieved by putting someone in a cell, so be it, but that's not particularly important to us. The point is to make them stop doing what it is that caused them to be targeted. Now, think about that in terms of political objectionability. Second case I'd like to mention would be that of the James Younger gang, Clay County, Missouri. A little bit after the Reno gang, okay, Jameses are usually credited with inventing train robbery. They weren't. The Renos were first. That's what happened to the Renos. How they solved the Jesse James case is basically pay a guy, Bob Ford, $10,000 to go in and shoot him in the back of the head at point blank range. So you got essentially assassination. Now, that's a successful solution to the case. That solved the James Younger case. They got Jesse James killed. You can think Jesse James is a great guy out of Americana legend, or you can think he was a thug. It doesn't really matter. The operational technique is what is at issue. That's how they resolved the case. You know, consider that in terms of, say, the Hampton Clark assassinations, Black Panther leaders in Chicago in 1969, and you'll see that what was established as a model in what was Jesse James, 1878? Well, 1969, they're still carrying out exactly the same operational technique for exactly the same purpose, although more specifically on political grounds in 1969 than it was in Clay County. But you also have to understand the James Younger operation was a very political operation as well, in its way. Third one comes from the 1880s, has to do with the Molly Maguires, which is a militant labor organization in Pennsylvania coal fields. The way they resolved that one was to bring in a Pinkerton operative who... They were all Irish immigrants. Most of them were refugees, political refugees, Fabians and so forth, from Ireland that were wanted by the Brits. Well, they got an Irish Pinkerton agent by the name of McParlin to infiltrate as you know, his cover was that he was also a political fugitive from Ireland, had been involved in Fabian activities and so forth, made him set up pretty well. He managed to ingratiate himself with the leadership of the Molly Maguires, began to propose that they take particular actions that they probably would not otherwise have taken, okay, involving dynamite and closing mine shafts, a couple of assassinations of managerial staff of the mine owners and so forth. The big operations they were going to pull off, he had provided the dynamite, the plan, most of the rest of the logistics and so forth, and then when they showed up to carry out the bombing, police, mine police, were waiting for them. You had this mass hanging ultimately in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, of the entire Molly Maguire leadership. Okay, the star witness against him was a guy who had proposed the plan in the first place and made it possible to carry it out. So you have infiltration for intelligence gathering purposes, but you have something going way beyond intelligence gathering, which is the functioning of this infiltrator as an agent provocateur. Now, provocateurs will function in this way. They will also function in a highly disruptive way, rather than furthering operations of a criminal sort, as is defined by statutory code. They may try to prevent the organization from doing anything by spreading rumors within it, badjacking individuals and so forth. But all of this had been worked out in terms of the labor policing activities of the Pinkerton Detective Agency by 1890. And you got a sort of a disruption that occurs, a discontinuity in the history, where you have this big labor battle up north of here a bit. And it was kind of negative publicity, so the government severed its relationship with the Pinkerton Agency, then had to create its own Bureau of Investigation attached to the Justice Department. But when you're going to start up an investigative operation from zero, who are you going to get to staff it? Well, obviously, they went to the Pinkerton Agency and hired a bunch of Pinkertons, okay, to come on the federal payroll. So you've got this sort of crossover effect that's occurring. I mean, the Pinkertons' continuity in terms of manpower that were involved, the expertise involved, it's not disrupted at all. Same people. They began to train people within the federal domain for particular types of activity that were restricted by statute in terms of formal civil authority engaging in it, and that they would retire these guys early or otherwise pave the way for them to go into the industrial police force. So you've got basically a structural interlock between the FBI and these private police forces that are out there at the present time. And I don't know how many people are aware of it, but there's a lot more private cops out there on the street than there are public employed police. And they're not constrained even nominally to conform to rules of legality. You know, one sector, rather than just take a pretty sensational example to make the point, you got bounty hunters who are often trained in police agencies for the line of work that they go in. Bounty hunters can kick in your door. They require no warrant, okay? Use all due armed force to ensure that you will come with them. That's their job. But they're not constrained to obey any of the protections, safeguards, and so forth that at least nominally apply to the police. It's just wide open. Well, among other things, the industrial police forces and the private security agencies and so forth have been able to gather on a risk-free basis kinds of intelligence that are statutorily prohibited with regard to the FBI or local red squads or so forth. They do it anyway, but they can have these guys that they've trained and placed in positions out there in cooperating agencies do it on a nominally private basis, but also very consistently, and have a much broader intelligence gathering net. They also pinpoint targets, okay? But in the process of creating that structure where you've got a private-public interlock in terms of intelligence gathering and repression, which is beginning to emerge by the 1920s, and J. Edgar Hoover, who becomes the 50-year director of the FBI, specialized in this and also actually got himself appointed as a Naval Reserve officer so that he could have a position within Naval intelligence. So he's got military intelligence feeding him. He's got industrial intelligence operations feeding him, and he begins to proliferate these connections with the political squads, New York City, Philadelphia, Chicago, so forth. So you've got a localized intelligence gathering capacity, but also an operational capacity, a strike capacity, that they run the kinds of things that were developed by the Pinkertons in a much more broad-based and efficient manner, ever more efficient, ever more intelligence, knowledge being power. They collect data on people so they can select targets fairly surgically. after a period of time. And as with the Hampton Clark case, which was mentioned a while ago, these were not FBI personnel, per se, that carried out the assassinations. They were local police, a special squad of state's attorney's police, okay, who were operating basically under command and control of the FBI. The FBI provided them the intelligence information necessary to carry out the raid, provided them a pretext, withdrew that when it turned out to not be true, but kept their hands clean, or they had a Chinese wall, as it's called, built up that lasted for about 10 years against intensive investigation in the aftermath of that. So you got the emergence of a centralized hub of priority setting, command and control, and an intelligence data gathering. Also, the analysis of this intelligence data that's collected and fed back out then to various sectors, whether it be local police, state police agencies, or private police agencies. The FBI is filtering the information on a continuous basis and putting it back out, who they should be paying attention to, and so on. By the time you get to the end of the COINTELPRO era, and COINTELPRO, for those who don't know, is an acronym. It was actually a cryptonym because it's a secret operation, secret because it was understood to be illegal at the time. It runs from 1956 to 1971 when it was ostensibly terminated. In that period, you see the full inventory of techniques that are still being applied, sort of laid out in a continuum of order. And the order which this continuum applies, they'll start with, I guess you have to say, the least objectionable or least intensive or the least extreme method in order to neutralize their political targets. And if that doesn't work, they move to the next. And if that doesn't work, they move to the next, to the point where you end up with, like Hampton and Clark, with assassination being the means. That begins with a pretty much continuous tone of disinformation. And that operates at a couple levels. Okay, at one level, it's continuous feed into mass media sources. There was a point when the FBI had something like 450, what they call collaborating or friendly journalists, who would literally sign their byline to copy that was written in the basement of the FBI building and presented as news, okay? So that's for general public consumption, but they also put infiltrators, people to spread rumors and disinformation inside the organizations that are targeted. And that's a provocateur function, but at a fairly low level. And if they can discredit individuals that they define as being the key organizers of the targeted groups, or the groups themselves, prevent them from recruiting or having resonance with the public, that can be the neutralization, and if that works, they may stop. If that doesn't work, they go to a higher level where they will take more proactive steps within the organizations or within communities to get people literally targeted for perhaps physical abuse and so forth. That might deter people. They will pass out disinformation about your personal life. Did you know that your girlfriend was sleeping with that guy there? Yeah. Well, I didn't figure you knew, but I saw the other night the evidence that was true. Okay, and you can trust me because, well, I'm just got your well-being at heart. This kind of nonsense. You, on the other hand, were out there soliciting funds for our organization the other day. I know that you took down a couple $100 because I put $100 in a can just to see what would happen. And you only turned in $50. So you pocketing the difference. To spread this kind of suspicion, dissension, ultimately within organizations to cause them to unravel. Potentially could be criminal offense as well. Graduate from that, and actually usually is coupled, have things like pretext arrest. You have a case in 1967, that's going to take me another couple minutes, okay? 1967 in Philadelphia, having to do with the Revolutionary Action Movement, where the technique was to enter into a collaborative relation with the Red Squad of the Philadelphia Police Department, and basically it was just to arrest known members of the Revolutionary Action Movement. RAM members were arrested every time they set foot on the street for any possible pretext, absolutely no hope of conviction. They never intended to take this stuff to trial. The idea was to get people, lock them up, make them make bail, mount a legal defense, or at least retain an attorney, all of which costs money, and as soon as they walk out on bail, arrest them for something else and put them right back in. They got to make bail again, okay. They got to have a lawyer retained for that one too. Now they walk out, bust them again. And basically they dissolved an organization. They were real proud of it. It was an extra legal utilization of the legal system. But in more serious cases where they got a higher profile individual target, sometimes a group target, they'll go actually try to make the case. And then you end up with an extra legal utilization of the judicial system that can result in actual penal time. Okay, they'll fabricate evidence, they'll withhold exculpatory evidence, they'll introduce their snitches, they'll deny their snitches to be the key witnesses against people. Got cases which are fairly famous of this having been used during the COINTELPRO period. In New York, for example, you got a member of the Panther 21, one of the leaders of Black Panther chapter in New York City by the name of Daruba Bin Wahad, that ended up spending 19 years in maximum security in New York State, okay, for having attempted to murder police officers. As they said, the FBI ballistics lab had determined that the weapon that was supposedly the key piece of evidence against him, on the one hand, was not the weapon used in the shooting, okay, and you got this case of a key witness, Pauline Johnson, being held for almost 2 years against, originally it was probably with her permission, but ultimately against her will, and told she was never going to be released unless she entered first-hand information, or supposed eyewitness information that would confirm the case. So you got both of those factors in that particular New York case, and there's several others that I could go into. You got Geronimo G. Giaga out in California that it ended up doing 27 years, okay, on the basis of snitch testimony, and the guy actually sat on a stand and denied that he was a snitch, okay, and the FBI knew it was impossible for him to committed the act for which he was convicted, and they set him up to be convicted because they had, in process of electronic surveillance, okay, identified him as being present at a Black Panther Central Committee meeting in Oakland, California, when the murder for which he was convicted was committed in Santa Monica at the same time. Now, that's 350 miles away. And denied that they had surveilled, okay, when that was originally put up on appeal that the surveillance would disclose this, they denied that they had been engaged in the electronic surveillance. Then when it came out in 1975, the Church Committee hearings, that they had in fact been engaged in electronic surveillance, they said, oops, oh, we misspoke. And the judge ordered them to provide the phone tap logs for the particular period that would either confirm or deny Pratt's story. And they purported to have lost the phone logs for that particular two-week period of time. And he was left in prison. Now, he spent 8.5 years in solitary as a result of this, and it was a conviction that was, to the knowledge of the people who put him in prison, as bogus as a $3 bill. Pseudo-gangs figure into the next level, which is to foment actual violence to get people assassinated. You got a famous case of that in Los Angeles with creation of the so-called US Panther War, where they're putting out, the FBI is putting out derogatory cartoons of both sides in the style of the literature that they produce in order to take what they referred to as two violence-prone groups and set them at odds. Their body count on that was 6 dead Panthers, up to the point where, as in Hampton and Clark, when all else fails, they do it themselves. So you've got this continuum that runs from just whispering campaigns and misreporting in the press up through actual political assassination as part of the inventory of what it is they, by mandate, were supposed to have stopped as of 1971, when a formal termination of COINTELPRO was ordered for reasons we'll go into later. My own organization, the American Indian Movement, was hit more comprehensively and intensively in South Dakota 3 years after that, and the Black Panthers were hit during the period of the height of the COINTELPRO repression, which may give you some indication of how much stoppage they actually did. But anybody with questions beyond that might want to talk to some people who are survivors of Waco or Ruby Ridge, because it's not just, it usually is, but not just what might be termed left dissident formations that are targeted and hit. Okay, it's anybody that threatens the stability of the order of things as it's encountered. And I've already talked too long, so now I'm going to stop.
That was Professor Ward Churchill speaking last February on a panel on government repression against activists. Next, from that same panel, we'll hear from Natsu Saito.
Okay, I'm Natsu Saito. I teach at Georgia State's Law School in Atlanta, and I do work in the areas of international law and human rights. I want to talk about some of the specifics of the USA Patriot Act and some of the other legislation and the executive action that has come about in the last few months, because I think that they have serious consequences for those of us who are engaged in political activities. But I really, really think it's important to to put this in the kind of context that Ward was talking about and to realize that none of this is new. They didn't just think of this. They were waiting to bring out these specifics of this legislation and these actions. But beyond that, it is completely consistent with everything that the United States government has done since the moment of its inception to try to foster the particular kind of social order and political order that we have. And this is true both in the context of domestic law and international law. I think that a lot of us are here tonight because we're upset about both the way in which this new repressive domestic legislation is coming down in the context of the post-September 11th U.S. foreign policy actions. And I think we have to note that, number one, these are integrally related, right? We can't separate these out, domestic repression from U.S. foreign policy. And in both those contexts, we have this very important context in history that we see them both coming out of, right? We can't look at U.S. foreign policy in isolation. I'm very pleased that there's been mobilization with respect to sort of an anti-war effort in the last couple of months. But the foreign policy that the United States is engaging in now is a continuation of its foreign policy, as I said, from its inception, but certainly directly, clearly, for the last 10 years. And even though I'm, of course, pleased to see people mobilizing at this point, I find it disturbing, too, that we're mobilizing now. You know, it looks suspiciously like when U.S. lives are directly at stake and when those of us who engage in political activities at home are under more severe constrictions. You know, if we really cared about these actions, we would have been protesting the U.S. policies in Iraq over the past 10 years that have caused well over 500,000 Iraqi children to die. You know, we would be protesting U.S. policies with respect to the suppression of the Palestinians and on and on and on, because this is the background. We can't wait until all of a sudden U.S. lives at stake to get involved in that. And in that context, it sort of in looking at trying to get U.S. foreign policy to comply with international law, we can't separate that out from domestic policy and domestic repression. A lot of what Ward was talking about in terms of COINTELPRO and these kinds of governmental activities that do go back, they were explicitly aimed at suppressing political dissent and political organization. They're explicitly directed at groups particularly that have been struggling for racial and economic justice. And this is all directly tied into both U.S. foreign policy and the history of domestic policy, right? We can't look at globalization now and protest that without realizing that globalization goes back at least as far as the Portuguese slave trade on the west coast of Africa, right? We have to look at all of these things as part of this continuation. And the current U.S. refusal to comply with international law, the current version of it, and our refusal to sign on to human rights treaties, our refusal to comply with customary international law with respect to war, and the treatment of political dissenters and treatment of prisoners, all that. A lot of this dates directly back to the post-World War II era in which, after the formation of the United Nations, with its advocacy of racial, social, religious, other kinds of equality, the United States government, this was an era of explicit apartheid in America, right? This was when we had Jim Crow laws. A lot of the opposition to U.S. participation in human rights treaties had to do with the determination that the international community was not going to make us dismantle segregation here. And so to the extent that you care about U.S. foreign policy, you have to also care about U.S. domestic policy. And to me, you know, people who say that they cared about international human rights but didn't care about segregation at home are being hypocrites. And in the same way, we have to look. There are extremely repressive domestic measures being implemented now, but there's a direct history of that. But there's also, we cannot complain about the fact that political activists are being targeted and have been given 20 and 30 year sentences when we sit around and we allow young African American men to be sent away for life for a grand total of $110 worth of drugs or two shoplifting charges, right? We can't do that. Those that is as political a struggle as any of this is. And I have to sort of put all this in that context, because otherwise I think it's very self-serving for us to be protecting our own very narrow interests with respect to this new legislation. As we said, a lot of this current legislation dates directly back to the COINTELPRO era and the history of these same agencies, the, quote, intelligence agencies that are being given expanded criminal enforcement powers and intelligence powers. And a lot of what's happening right now is the rollback of restrictions that were put into place as a consequence of the exposure of these blatantly illegal activities in the 50s, 60s, and 70s by, among other things, the Senate Select Committee to Study Government Operations with Respect to Intelligence Activities, usually known as the Church Committee. And the Church Committee reports are out there. They're available. You can go to the library. You can find out what the United States Senate said that the FBI and the CIA were doing. What the Church Committee documented was this long range of the kinds of activities that Ward was talking about in terms of repression of political dissent and activities. And one of the things that happened, though, directly after that, even though supposedly some of this was being rolled back, was in 1978, something was passed called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And that set up Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act as FISA, right? That's the acronym. And FISA courts were set up, which allowed for secret operations in intelligence matters. And so we have, even though there was a supposed restriction on the activities of intelligence agencies, we have had, since 1978, the ability of these secret courts to hear evidence and to issue warrants with respect to intelligence matters. And one of the really important things about the new legislation is that it merges much more blatantly than had officially been happening before, criminal investigations and intelligence operations. One of the big myths about that I'm sure you are aware of currently is that what's being done now is a matter of security and safety, and that it is part of fighting crime, right? This has always been the way it's been pitched. It's been pitched since early abolitionists were deemed supporters of sedition and rebellion, right? It goes from that period all the way up through any kinds of political dissent have been labeled as criminal. Well, now we have the blurring of the line between criminal and intelligence investigations. We also have dramatically limited judicial oversight, so that government agencies are much freer to officially act than they were before. And we have the elimination of any barriers of intergovernmental information sharing. So it's not like any of this stuff wasn't happening before, right? We know that it was, but it wasn't necessarily legal before. And one of the big differences is now that it's legal, it means it can be used against people in criminal courts, right? So before, if they got information on you illegally, they might use it against you surreptitiously, but it didn't mean that they could convict you on the basis of it. And that's a big difference. Let me just talk about some of the specific provisions of the law, and we can go into more detail if you want later. One is that a really important piece of the new law is that it broadens the definition of foreign intelligence information. Okay? This is sort of a term of law, right? Foreign intelligence information. It now encompasses any information, whether or not it pertains to a U.S. person. It used to be restricted to when it dealt with U.S. citizens or residents, but it's no longer restricted, relating to the ability of the U.S. to protect against hostile acts of foreign powers or their agents, or regarding a foreign power that relates to the national defense, security, or conduct of the foreign affairs of the United States. Okay? It used to say necessary to, but now it just says relates to. So any information that has anything to do with any other country and relates to the conduct of the foreign affairs of the United States is foreign intelligence information. Okay, then the question is, what do we do with this, right? Now the federal rules of evidence have been changed so that any foreign intelligence information which is obtained from a grand jury can be shared with other persons, right? And I'm sure you're familiar a little bit at least with how grand juries work, but what's important about them is that you don't have the normal protections of criminal evidence law rules or of being able to having not having to testify. You can, you know, you've seen people plead the Fifth or claim the Fifth Amendment in the context of grand juries. You don't have to give information that's directly incriminating of yourself to a grand jury, but you have to give information about anybody else that they ask you about, right? Otherwise, you're in jail for contempt. And so now this information can be obtained from somebody, anybody else besides you, right? And then used against those persons in criminal convictions, as long as, and it can be shared with any other agencies, as long as it's in this really broad definition of foreign intelligence information. Any of this kind of information that comes from wiretaps or other kinds of surveillance can be disclosed to any federal law enforcement or intelligence agencies. FISA-authorized searches have been expanded. You've heard, I'm sure, about these, what they call sneak and peek warrants or black bag jobs, where they can get a warrant where they don't have to tell you about it, and they can come into your house and search your house, your computers, whatever. And the only time you might hear about it is if they actually introduce this evidence against you in a court of law. They never actually have to tell you about it. The FBI can get orders from a FISA court or from any federal magistrate requiring any person or business to produce any books, records, documents, or items merely upon certification that it seeks them for foreign intelligence information purposes. So if an FBI agent goes and says, with that broad definition of foreign intelligence information, that it certifies to a federal magistrate anywhere in the country or a FISA judge that that's why they want it, the judge has no discretion. The judge has to issue the warrant. The only caveat on that is that with respect to U.S. persons, it can't be done solely because of First Amendment protected activity. In other words, they can't only do it because they don't like your speech or your associations, but they can also do it because they don't like those things. There's telephone and internet monitoring that I'm sure you've heard about. They can theoretically get to-from information on the internet stuff, right? But they say they don't have the technology now to only get the to-from information, so they're just not going to read the text. And they're roving wiretaps so that the wiretap no longer goes with the telephone line. The wiretap follows you to whatever phone you use. What that means is that it doesn't literally physically follow you, but they have permission to tap any phone that you use, right? So you go to your friend's house and make calls from your friend's house. They don't have to have a separate warrant for your friend's phone. Right, this warrant will cover any of those phones that you use. What's interesting about this is that the Department of Justice sent the House and Senate Judiciary Committees letters asserting that they believe this to not only be constitutional, their theory is that the executive branch has inherent authority to engage in warrantless counterintelligence searches. So they're saying, we were nice enough to get you, Congress, to pass this, but we don't actually think there's any constitutional restrictions on any kind of warrantless counterintelligence services by the executive branch. That's the current administration's position on this. All of this information can be shared with the CIA. All of the restrictions on sharing information with the CIA that came in the wake of the Operation Chaos revelations of the Church Committee in the 70s have been rolled back. And you've heard, I'm sure, about these sunset provisions, but the sunset provisions are very specific. It only applies to some of it. They really don't provide any protection. There's lots of other important things. Some of it has to do with the money laundering stuff is important. You know, you think, well, you know, we don't engage in money laundering, right? That's big time money stuff. But in fact, what they're doing is that allows them to trace funds of any kinds of organizations. Right, and they've used this a lot in the immigration context, even before the passage of this act, where they have identified organizations as being subversive in some form, and then they've been deporting people on the basis of you went to a Palestinian dinner dance and you gave a $25 check, and that organization, that was a fundraiser for this orphanage, and this orphanage is connected to this other group, and this other group is connected to this third group, and this third group is connected to Hamas, and therefore you gave money to a terrorist organization when you went to that dinner dance, and now you're deported. Okay? So that's, you know, when they talk about money laundering, they're talking about being able to follow the trail of your $5 check wherever they want to follow it. It's a lot easier to detain non-citizens in the long run, but that doesn't really seem to matter because they seem to be doing that at will anyway, which we'll talk about in a minute. Student privacy, you know, they've basically they can get any records they want from any educational institution, and the institutions have been just voluntarily handing this stuff over left and right. So, you know, don't expect any privacy there. Let me just say basically just two more things. One is I just want to point out that there's a new crime that they're calling domestic terrorism, right? Before September 11th, and again, you know, this actually has nothing to do with September 11th, right? They had this stuff ready to roll, but it was very convenient. Before September 11th, the law prohibited international terrorism. It prohibited terrorism transcending national borders, and there was a federal terrorism crime. A lot of the more repressive domestic stuff came about since the 80s. There have been, you know, the Reagan administration introduced a lot of repressive legislation, and then in 1996 we had the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, and there's been a lot of this stuff that's been coming in bits and pieces anyway. Anyway, so there was lots of law that if we're looking for law that the September 11th attacks violated. There was plenty of that law, but they created a new crime that's domestic terrorism, and a person commits that crime if within the United States they engage in activity involving acts dangerous to human life that violate the laws of the U.S. or any state. Okay, so endanger human life, that could mean blocking an intersection, right? Violate any of the laws of the United States or any state. So we now have federal jurisdiction over state criminal law violations. And appear intended to either intimidate or coerce a civilian population or influence the policy of a government, meaning including ours, right, by intimidation or coercion, or affect the conduct of a government by mass destruction, assassination, or kidnapping. So if you're trying to influence government policy and you endanger human life and you break any law at all, right, this is domestic terrorism. Not only somebody who engages in domestic terrorism, the government can then wiretap their homes. They can engage, you know, do all kinds of things. But one of the two really important things is their provisions for harboring domestic terrorists, which means letting somebody who fits this definition sleep on your living room floor, and it means providing material support, which is any kind of money or any kind of support. Right? There's dramatically expanded federal, state, local law enforcement cooperation, and expanded powers of the CIA. The director of the CIA, rather than the attorney general, is now in charge of establishing priorities for gathering intelligence in the United States. This would appear to directly contravene the charter of the CIA, but nonetheless, there it is. Let me just say, you know, the other big pieces, of course, are that this is just that one law, right, which is one of a series of a lot of laws. The Executive Department has engaged in lots of other activities, the most dramatic being the detention of, as of November, at least 1,200 non-citizens, right? I mean, these people have just been disappeared, right? I mean, we talk about disappearances in Latin America. That's what's happening here, right? They stopped telling us how many when people started getting upset. We know that, you know, they're detained. There still are thousands of people in detention. We don't know exactly who or where or why, and most of them have not been charged. Most of them are being held under very, very harsh security, you know, the kinds of conditions that are supposedly reserved for the most dangerous and violent convicted people, and these people are not convicted or even charged. There's this voluntary questioning of at least 5,000 young men of Middle Eastern origin. And what's happening is, I don't know, some of you may have seen, I saw some of them from the University of Michigan, some students being interviewed on TV, and they said they had gone in for this voluntary questioning, which of course they didn't think was actually voluntary. And they said the agents were asking them questions like, have you seen anybody engaged in any criminal activity? And they said, no, right? And the guy said, you've never seen anybody underage drinking? Right? I mean, these are college students, right? And so then they go, well, yes, of course. Well, did you know that, you know, there's X and Y and Z, you know, penalties for perjury and for lying to a federal officer and blah, blah, blah? Which means, right, they're not going to prosecute these kids for perjury right now, but it means that they've got, you know, they can deport them whenever they want. They can force them to turn into informants whenever they want, right? And this is the kind of stuff that's going on with respect to these cases. Ashcroft has unilaterally thrown privileged attorney-client communication out the window between people, anybody who's detained, not convicted, but detained. And then, you know, of course, they've introduced this this military order for military tribunals. And then finally, they've really restricted the access we have to information through FOIA, through the Freedom of Information Act. Ashcroft has sent out a memo to all the heads of the federal agencies and departments that doesn't exactly, in so many words, say don't ever give out any information under FOIA anymore. But what it says is any information you give out, you know, these are very sensitive times, and any information you could give out could endanger the national security. And if you give out any information that endangers the national security, it's going to be your fault. But if you deny any request, we will back you up all the way. Okay, so there we go.
That was Natsu Saito, a professor of law from Georgia State University in Atlanta. She spoke last February in New York City. You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.